I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, is now in control of Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, after Iraqi forces fled last week. Its advance on Baghdad was slowed over the weekend, although it continues to control territory in north and west Iraq, including Tal Afar, which fell to the Sunni militants on Sunday. ISIS posted gruesome photos online that show mass executions of captive Iraqi soldiers. Their claim of killing 1,700 cannot be independently verified. These actions have caught the American and Iraqi governments off guard. The Maliki government wants the U.S. to get involved militarily, while President Obama mulls over his options. Today on Radio Times, how did this happen and what happens next? We begin with Liz Sly. She's Washington Post bureau chief for Beirut, covering Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and beyond. And she joins us from Baghdad, Iraq. Liz Sly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Is Baghdad on a war footing?
I would say that is a bit of an exaggeration to say it's on a war footing. A few days ago, everybody believed that the ISIS were going to rush in here and slaughter everybody, and there was a mood of panic. Now, nobody believes that that is going to happen in Baghdad. People have relaxed a little bit. But to the extent that the whole country is at war, to the extent that Iraq feels that it is fighting a war against these militants, then very much war, what's going on in the north, the war in the north, is very much on everybody's minds.
How close is ISIS to Baghdad?
Well, the actual surge of ISIS fighters that we saw stopped at about 60 kilometers away. But everybody knows that ISIS is inside the city. They've been blowing up, they've been car bombing the city for ages. There was a suicide bomber yesterday. There are attacks on checkpoints at night, that kind of thing. So it's made everybody very jumpy. Everybody knows that they're here, they're in the city, and they could attack at any time.
I looked at some of the photos that reportedly posted by ISIS online. I'm sure you have looked at them as well. They cannot be verified, but nonetheless, ISIS seems to be claiming ownership of those photos. What do you make of them?
The photographs of the executed soldiers, you mean?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I'm quite sure that those photographs are authentic. They look authentic. It's exactly the kind of thing that ISIS does. Remember, we've been seeing this for 2 years in Syria, seeing photographs of piles of executed bodies, of people being executed on videos by both sides in the conflict in the Syrian war. This is normal. This is what's been going on every day in Syria for a long, long time now. And now it's come back to Iraq, and it was here in Iraq 8 years ago as well. So this is not entirely unusual for this region.
So ISIS, in a sense, started in Iraq, moved to Syria, and now has come back to Iraq?
Yes, you can put it like that, yes.
And what do they want? Do they want their own country?
They want a country. They're very much against the whole idea of nationhood in the Western sense of the word. They believe in the Islamic Ummah, which means it means nation roughly, but it's it basically means that the whole world is Muslim, and that it's all one world, and it's all ruled by one leader, who is the Caliph, who is heir to the legacy of the Prophet Muhammad. They basically want to restore the system of governance that existed in the earliest days of Islam in the 7th century.
And who is their leader?
Their leader is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He is a former fighter with al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was detained by the U.S. military. He was released by the U.S. military. And in about 2011, I think, he became lead. 2010, he became leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was then called Islamic State of Iraq. And now it's called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and he is in charge.
Where do they get their weapons? Where do they get their money? There were reports this morning that they've been able to, I guess, rob banks or financial institutions in order to get some of their money. But where does ISIS get its support?
this has been one of the big mysteries. Right? I mean, throughout the time that the Americans were in Iraq, I was here for much of that time, one of the questions we would ask them is, where do they get their money? They would, they would kill them and they would defeat them, but they wouldn't go away. They would defeat them in battles, but they wouldn't go away. And the financing was obviously key. And we'd say, where do they get their money? And for some reason, in 8 years, the Americans were here, and they never solved the problem of where ISIS gets its money from. We know that they rob banks. We know that they do kidnappings. We know that they extort merchants, especially in Mosul. It appears they were very strong, like in the shadows in Mosul, shaking down businessmen. Everybody had to give a contribution to ISIS before the collapse of the city, before they took over the city last week. So they've had a variety of means and methods of getting money over the years. And also they get donations from wealthy people, but somehow nobody's ever been able to find out who those wealthy people are.
Do they target civilians?
I should say they don't target civilians, but of course they do, because they impose such rigorous and strict rules that almost no civilian can survive without violating those rules in some way. And the rules include, of course, membership of any political organization that might oppose them. Even mild civic society groups in Syria, their members are being executed for not being the kind of Islamist that ISIS wants them to be. And if you're the wrong religion as well, they say that they respect religions, but what they tend to do is burn down churches and execute people of the wrong religion as well.
There were reports last week that something like 500,000 people fled Mosul when it was basically overrun by ISIS. Where did those people go? And I was also reading over the weekend of reports of people returning, believing that they might be better under ISIS than they would under government security forces.
Well, yes. Now, this is a big issue because, of course, you can blame ISIS for being a not very nice organization, and you can talk about all the nasty things that they do. But when you think that there are some Iraqis who would prefer to live under ISIS than under the government that the Americans set up in Iraq, you realize you have a really, really big problem with the government that the Americans set up in Iraq. The Maliki government is perceived as arrogant, corrupt, and favoriting its own sect and discriminating against Sunnis. And yes, we have talked to people who have said the end of the humiliation under Maliki is something that we welcome and are celebrating. And those people believe they will be better off under ISIS. Now, of course, we've seen a similar thing happen in Syria, where some people have tolerated these jihadis, these extremists, because they think it would be better than Assad, and they think it will help them get rid of Assad. And after a few months of living under this kind of rule, they're not very happy with it, and now they're stuck with it. And this is one of the big issues that's going on in Syria at the moment. I do not believe that most of the people in Mosul really, really want this kind of rule, but it tells you a lot that they, at the moment, they are welcoming it as an alternative to Maliki.
Liz, why do you think the forces working for the Maliki government, the government forces in Mosul, basically fled?
There's so many stories about that. I think you've got a situation where the lack of cohesion in the country came together in that moment when ISIS surged into the city. A lot of those forces who are loyal to Maliki, they know they're hated in the city. They know what's going to happen to them if they're caught. They also don't believe that they've got anything to do with these people. They're Shia soldiers in a Sunni city. Why should they stay and fight for it? So they just upped and left. Now, there's a lot of theories going around as well that there was a deal struck. The commanders left. Some people say that they left because their commanders left. It's very murky and very difficult to work out what was going on. But I think what you did see was just a massive collapse of what should have been the glue that binds Iraq together. We found out there was no glue.
You covered the Iraq war. Are you seeing things that seem very familiar to what you observed 4, 5, 6 years ago?
Well, we've got a number of different kinds of things that went on in that time. We're now wondering if there's going to be American airstrikes. This will be like the third time around I've waited for American airstrikes on Iraq, wondering if they're coming or not and when they might come. And so there's that similarity. And then, of course, in the middle of the last decade, you had Iraq break down into sectarian killings in which Sunnis and Shia were just basically nakedly slaughtering each other on the streets. And I think we could... What's going on in northern Iraq now is a slightly different version of that. It is a very extreme group that most Sunnis do not support either. So we haven't quite reached that point yet, but of course fears are massively high that we will reach that point. And right now I'm going around talking to people, asking them if they think we will reach that point. Mm. And opinion seems to be divided. Some people say that Iraqis learned their lesson from those years and are not going to fall down into that trap again and start killing each other. But other people indeed are very, very scared.
Even going back to ISIS, my understanding it was in part inspired by Al-Qaeda, but then earlier this year rejected by Al-Qaeda.
Yes, it's fallen out with Al-Qaeda, that's for sure. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is a very stubborn and assertive leader, and I don't think Ayman Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, is very happy with this upstart who's kind of like claiming all the glory and trying to absorb other groups without permission. So they had a lot of arguments about who was in charge. And eventually Ayman Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, washed his hands of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Mm-hmm. I believe it's a lot of it is a personal dispute between two kind of big egos who both want to be in charge. But at the same time, I think Ayman Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, was rather worried that these ISIS tactics and the way it's behaving are going to alienate a lot of people in the world from Al-Qaeda.
Liz, when you talk to people in Iraq, what do they tell you about America? What do they think about the United States?
Everybody's like kind of so disillusioned and fed up with America. Everybody believes America to cause this problem. It doesn't matter what side you're on. I've just been around talking to people today from all different points of view, and it's just America. This is all of America's mess. This is the mess that America did and left behind. What differs is their interpretation of what it was that America did wrong. They favored this side, they favored that side. I've talked to Sunnis who are against the American presidents, Shia who are against the Americans. Everybody's just fed up with America and disillusioned.
I notice today, in fact, some of your reporting is that the U.S. Embassy is reducing some of its personnel.
That's right. There's a very big embassy here. There's thousands of people. They've announced a drawdown in the numbers because of the threat of violence. They've also announced that they're going to beef up security by bringing in some new security personnel, and the Pentagon has announced that it will be contributing some extra people to the embassy here. I think that's very interesting because, you know, I mean, more than a decade ago, America, you know, 150,000 American troops came here. It's a massive projection of power. And now you've got Iraq completely falling apart and the embassy's withdrawing its diplomats. It shows you that, you know, all that projection of power didn't really go very far here.
Well, Liz Sly, I really appreciate the fact that you were able to join us this morning on Radio Times. Thank you so much. And be safe there as well.
Thank you.
And that's Liz Sly. She's Washington Post bureau chief in Beirut. She has been covering Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and again joined us from Beirut. We're going to take a very short break and then talk with our two guests waiting in the wings, Andrew Tabler and Douglas Olivant. We are talking about the crisis in Iraq and much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
Guitar legend Richard Thompson says rock and roll ain't all it's cracked up to be.
I find it bombastic, you know, egotistical, overinflated. But whereas I find pop music a lot more honest. You hear a pop song on the radio or something, you think, wow, listen to that horn arrangement, you know, that's really good. So I like sort of intelligent pop music.
Oops, I did it again. I play with your...
Folk rock hero Richard Thompson joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, a guide to saving for retirement when it's decades away, and it starts with skipping that latte.
Pay yourself first, and what I mean by that is just putting that money away into the 401k plan and just pretend it's gone forever.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking in this hour of Radio Times about the crisis in Iraq. And joining us now is Andrew Tabler, Senior Fellow in the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. He's co-founder, former editor-in-chief of Syria Today, a Syria's first private sector English language newspaper, or I should say magazine, and author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Andrew Tabler, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
Also with us, Douglas Ollivant, Senior National Security Fellow with the New America Foundation. He's a retired Army officer. His last assignment in government was as Director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and Obama administrations. He's now Senior Vice President of Mantid International, a global strategic consulting firm with offices in Washington, Beirut, and Baghdad. And Douglas Ollivant, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much, Marty.
Can I begin with you, Douglas Ollivant? And based on what we just heard from Liz Sly joining us from Baghdad, are we witnessing the partition of Iraq?
I don't think so. It's too early to tell, but I think anyone who now is trying to predict what Iraq's going to look like in 30 or 90 or 180 days just doesn't know what that's not prudent right now. We don't know what it's going to look like.
To you, Andrew Tabler, and I'm interested because you are an authority on Syria, and we're talking about this group ISIS that seemed to have gained a fair amount of territory in Syria, now obviously moving into Iraq. How do you understand ISIS?
ISIS filled up a vacuum inside of Syria, particularly in eastern Syria, adjacent to the Iraqi border, over 2013. Of course, it dates back, you know, to originally from Iraq, but was sort of transplanted over the border. Grew in the chaos of the war in Syria, and grew in terms of the territory that it controlled very quickly following last autumn's what they call in government the non-strike incident, when President Obama walked back from his red line concerning chemical weapons, enforcing punitive strikes on the Assad regime. It mostly did that not necessarily out of military prowess, but because a lot of groups in the country thought it was being, the moderate groups and the other Islamist factions thought that the United States was completely staying out of it, as were the Western countries, and in advance. That, in turn, has been then pushed back, and ISIS has been pushed back by some of the other moderate factions inside of Syria since then. But it's been a problem in Syria for well over, you know, a year and a half. It's now only becoming a problem in Iraq again, and I think that's why it's setting off alarm bells, because of its lightning strikes and in quick advances, and also the threats to a lot of the U.S. investments in Iraq.
Douglas Ollivant, let me go back to you and the United States. As we know, spent years and a lot of money training and equipping Iraqi forces, and yet we hear in Mosul they basically dropped their weapons and fled for probably a whole host of reasons. But does that raise questions about the kind of training that the U.S. was doing?
Well, I think we'll know more in the coming days as we see the units from the south coming up and watch how they perform. I think Liz gave a great overview of what we know and don't know about the performance of the Iraqi army in Mosul. You know, the simplest explanation is, you know, they just weren't very good and they didn't have the morale and the training to stay. But there may be a lot of other factors at play. They may have been war weary. There's been a low grade insurgency going on in Mosul for some time. These soldiers have been probably, you know, shot at, sniped at on a daily basis for some time. They were intermixed units. There are theories that some of the Kurds and Sunnis may have fled or even flipped sides. There are, as Liz said, rumors about commanders being paid off. I think it'll take a long time for us to figure out the post-mortem on what happened up in Mosul.
But were these troops trained for this kind of insurgency?
No, absolutely not. They were trained to fight insurgency. They were not trained to fight a highly trained, highly motivated, ideologically dedicated extremely well-armed paramilitary force coming out of Syria. That's what's different now, and the difference between now and, say, 2006, 2007. The old al-Qaeda in Iraq, as a friend and I have written in a piece that was published on War on the Rocks about 3 weeks ago before this all started, the old al-Qaeda in Iraq, they were great saboteurs, they were great terrorists, they were great bomb makers, they were great kidnappers, extortionists. They were really terrible line soldiers, and if you got them in a firefight, they were they could be killed relatively easy. The new ISIS is not like that at all. They are, as Andrew said, reforged in the crucible of Syria, so to speak, and have come out very, very different. You know, they come out of the Iraq resistance, they come out of al-Qaeda, but Syria has transformed them into something very different and very singular.
Do you think, Andrew Tabler, they can be defeated militarily?
Yes, they can be defeated militarily. They can be, of course, you know, there could be airstrikes launched on ISIS, either by the United States, by Iran, by Iraqi forces inside of Syria, and the Assad regime has finally started attacking them. They haven't attacked them until now. But the problem with this this organization, like Douglas said, that they're like they're jihadists 2.0, or maybe even 3.0. I'm not knowing exactly what to call them. They're quite resilient. They're very flexible. They're very good at tactics. They're part of the organized sectarian militias that are taking over in what is today Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. And you know, ISIS is on the Sunni side. There are other Sunni factions, but then on the Shia side, there are tons of other factions, and we've seen them. We can find them in Iraq. We can find them in Syria. Hezbollah deployments from Lebanon into Syria and beyond. We have Iraqi Shia fighting in Syria as well. So ISIS is one of these many groups that are now taking over the role of small armies in these two countries. And it's what we've found until now is that they're hard to defeat, because when you defeat them in one place, they pop up in another area, because it's being generated by sectarian sentiments and the fact that the Maliki government and the Assad government regime in Syria don't include Sunnis in their equation, or don't account for their needs and desires and basic safety. So it's being generated by an ongoing political problem that bombing isn't going to solve.
Well, let me just pick up on that and toss that to you, Douglas Ollivant. And I do want to talk about the U.S., but nonetheless, how much do you think Maliki is to blame for what's happening in Iraq today?
Well, I think there are these two problems are distinct but interrelated. We have the ISIS problem, and as Liz said, you know, they have some pretty extreme goals, want to restore the caliphate in the entirety of the region. When they talk about ISIS and it being the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, they mean greater Syria, including Lebanon, Jordan, Israel. They have some pretty maximalist goals. So even were Iraq governed like Sweden, we'd still have an ISIS problem. Hmm. Now, that said, there are serious problems with Iraqi politics, and these two problems are interrelated. It's easy to throw the blame at Maliki, but I think the problem is much more complex than that. As I've been saying a lot lately, if Maliki has been no Nelson Mandela, that's because the Sunnis haven't generated a de Klerk to kind of lead them into a new role in Iraqi politics, to say to the Sunnis, you know, we're never going to rule again. We're a very small ethnic minority. We're kind of complicit in the crimes of the old regime. We can't turn to the Ba'ath. We can't turn to violence. We have to find a new way in Iraqi politics. So Maliki has certainly not been perfect and has in many ways exacerbated this crisis, but it's not like he's had a partner to work with either.
Well, that's Douglas Ollivant, again, Senior National Security Fellow with the New America Foundation. Also with us, Andrew Tabler, and he's a Senior Fellow in the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. We are talking about the crisis. I don't think there's any other word you can use, the crisis in Iraq. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY. Radio Times. Andrew Taylor, I know Syria is your area of expertise, but Maliki wants President Obama, the United States, to get militarily involved in Iraq. Obama seems reluctant, certainly, to put boots on the ground. But nonetheless, I guess there are these options of airstrikes or even drone strikes. How do you see whatever military options there could be?
I think that given the, I think what's notable about this president is that he starts out conversations with what he will not do instead of what he might do, or and so on. So it's a very different style than in the region. He's ruled out ground troops. That sounds pretty natural. I don't think the public would go for it. I don't think he wants to go for it. Looking forward, he has a number of options. He has direct airstrikes. He has, we have a fire alarm here, sorry.
That's okay, go ahead.
He has drone strikes he could rely on. He has combined efforts with other allies that he could rely on. He has other, so the question is, you know, he would be able to hit things in a pinpointed way. Could he do otherwise? How would he be able to move tactically on the ground? And that's where some of the most recent stories have come out concerning cooperation with Iran. Because Iran has put forces on the ground and probably will continue to put forces on the ground as this unfolds.
Well, and this is, you know, the sort of curious turn of events, Douglas Ollivant. It looks like, at least as of today, Iran and the United States are on the same side in this conflict.
You never thought you'd see this, but we are now at a point where it is not beyond the realm of imagining that in the coming week we will have U.S. Navy F-14s providing de facto air support to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps on the ground in Iraq. It's a very interesting situation. In effect, ISIS is fighting in two countries, in Iraq and in Syria. In Iraq, it appears that we'll be de facto aligned with the Iranians in fighting ISIS, while in Syria, we're kind of de facto aligned with ISIS fighting the Iranians. It's a very, very strange situation on each side of the border.
But what about a political solution? And Douglas Ollivant, I'll put this to you, and it seems like, at least as of today, the president is sort of thinking in that direction. Does the U.S. have any leverage over Maliki, for instance? To be more inclusive?
We can try. The politics in Iraq are just so dysfunctional. You know, Maliki has reached out to the Sunni on occasion. There was a bill that he tried to pass earlier this spring that would have put some limits on de-Ba'athification, given some pensions to the Saddam Hussein-era paramilitaries, the Saddam Fedayeen. And in a scene that's very reminiscent of American politics, Maliki's allies on the Shia side said, no, we just can't stand for that. And the Sunnis didn't want Maliki and a couple of the Sunni allies he'd worked this bill with to get a win before elections, so they voted against it as well. The Iraqi politics are dysfunctional on a scale that strongly resembles that of the U.S. Congress.
Well, and that opens up a whole other door there. But let me go back to you, Andrew Taylor. And Liz Sly was talking about the fact that when she talks to people in Baghdad, which is where she is today, it doesn't matter what side of this conflict they are on, they blame the United States. Does the U.S. have some responsibility for this crisis in Iraq?
I think it does in that the U.S. is a player in Iraqi politics since the invasion, but I don't think that they can really blame the U.S. for breaking Iraq. Iraq's broken for its own reasons, and it's because of the sectarian nature of its government and the reliance on primarily, you know, the Shia population, and excluding a lot of others. And that's always been a problem for countries like Syria and Iraq. They're dominated by minorities. In this case, they're both dominated by Shia minorities and aligned with Iran. And it causes problems, political problems, that are very difficult to resolve.
To you, Douglas Ollivant, and Colin Powell famously talked about the pottery barn rule. You break it, you own it. I mean, don't we have some responsibility in Iraq? Or for Iraq?
Certainly the Iraqis think so. And if you talk to the Iraqis, they really do blame this on 2003. And even going further back, we'll blame it on the United States not coming in and standing with the Shia when they rebelled against Saddam Hussein in the wake of our throwing his army out of Kuwait in 1991.
Right.
If you read the Twitter feeds right now, you're seeing lots of the Shia feeds talking about how, you know, the United States is going to deny us airstrikes now in our hour of need, just like they did in 1991. So the memories there are very, very long, and there's a lot of history at play here. Whether we own it, we do have a strategic framework agreement with Iraq. It's a non-binding executive agreement, but it does speak very strongly about our security cooperation with Iraq and the territorial integrity of Iraq.
Does the situation, though, Douglas, pose a danger to American interests?
Absolutely. We're very, very vested in stability in Iraq. Totally aside from Iraq itself and its oil production, every country that Iraq touches, we have interests in. You know, working around the horn, we have interests in Iran, we have interests in Turkey, we have interests in Syria, we have interests in Jordan, we have interests in Saudi Arabia, we have interests in Kuwait. It's not a country that, if it's dysfunctional, we can isolate mm-hmm. from all our other interests in the region.
Andrew Tabler, on the one side, there are people who say that it's the U.S.'s fault for invading in the first place, and others who are saying it's the U.S.'s fault because we left in, 2010 or 2011? Do we have Andrew Tabler? No, I think he dropped. Okay, we're going to try to get him back. Well, that's okay. I couldn't realize why people were pointing at me. Douglas Ollivant, let me put that to you because it's just you and me on the radio so far. Go ahead.
Can you restate the question?
Yeah, there are two sides. What I hear on one side are people saying, you know, it's because the U.S. invaded Iraq, that's why there are problems today. There are others who would say, no, it's because the U.S. left Iraq in 2011, leaving it in this vulnerable state, and that's why there are the problems that there are.
Well, the United States was always going to leave Iraq in 2011. My friend Colin Call has published a very good piece on that on Politico, how the politics of Iraq always necessitated that we were going to leave at the end of 2011, and I absolutely believe that. While this administration certainly wanted to leave Iraq in 2011, don't get me wrong,
right.
The local Iraqi politics would never have allowed the immunities that we require to leave troops in a country. So that's kind of a moot point. But is this about our invading Iraq and causing some chaos? Well, sure, that's part of it. On the other hand, the chaos of Iraq was being contained by the Saddam regime, and looking next door at Syria, you know, containing a regime like this isn't going to last forever, even if we do nothing.
But does that raise the questions about whether a country like Iraq needs then a strong man like a Saddam Hussein?
Well, it's certainly like it's never going to be governed like Sweden. You do have to. Iraqi politics. All Arab politics are pretty hardball. There's lots of elbows thrown. The rhetoric is very inflammatory. But on the other hand, we're starting to build a tradition of democratic transitions in Iraq. Now, at the national level, that's very difficult because you've got these three groups working. But if we look down at the provinces, we've now had democratic transition two or three times in those provinces. People expect that they can change things through elections. So it's not quite as bleak as I think people like to look. But, you know, that's a hard case to make this week, that's for sure.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and get some callers in as well. And that's Douglas Ollivant, Senior National Security Fellow with the New America Foundation and retired Army officer. His last assignment in government was as Director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and Obama administrations. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think the U.S. or anyone should do when it comes to Iraq? Give us a call, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
In your statement, you said that you came home and found your wife, that that she was already dead?
Downstairs, yeah.
That's Deputy Sheriff Molly Salverson interviewing a suspect in the new FX series Fargo, based on the popular Coen Brothers film. On the next Fresh Air, we meet series creator and writer Noah Hawley and Allison Tolman, who plays the deputy. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Creativity is a common theme that drives both entrepreneurs and artists. But creative people are often paradoxical, combining playfulness and discipline, or responsibility and irresponsibility. It's been recognized as so important that businesses are setting up creativity farms to improve innovative thinking. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices of the Family, Creativity, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Last week, militants affiliated with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, overran Mosul and are now in control of the second largest city in Iraq. ISIS posted some grisly photos of mass executions online. Iraqi President Maliki has asked the U.S. for military support. President Obama is mulling over that request and what the U.S. should or shouldn't do. And again, talking with Douglas Ollivant about what's going on in Iraq. And I should say that Andrew Tabler had to run out of the building because of the fire drill or fire alarm, and we hope to reconnect with him in a couple of minutes. Let me get Peter. I know. I'm sorry about that. Let me get Peter from Why I'm Missing to join our conversation. Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, so I was a little curious. Yeah, foreign policy reports that the Saudis are funding ISIS. If they are, why are journalists so unwilling to mention that? Previous guest from the Washington Post said she didn't know who was funding ISIS. And what does this say about our relationship with the Saudis, especially now we're thinking of talking to Iran? And then the other question I have is, we talked about the Western world or Western leadership, but it seems like only we are expected to do anything. You know, the Iraqis are blaming us, but they want us to help, not Europe. What's going on there?
Fair enough. Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And yes, Liz Sly from the Washington Post said that she has been, you know, tracking the money from for apparently ISIS and hasn't been able to get to the root of it. But nonetheless, do you think Saudi Arabia, Douglas Ollivant, is behind that?
I'm not an expert in threat financing, but we've seen a lot of articles this weekend about how not just the Saudis, but also the Qataris and Kuwaitis, not at the government level, but individuals in those countries, provided at least the seed money for ISIS. That said, I think, as Liz said, the consensus today is that it self-finances. It ran Mosul, you know, like the Soprano family, you know, doing extortion, you know, money laundering, kidnappings, things of this nature, and then and also selling the oil that it's captured in northern Syria. Also makes quite a bit of money doing that. Has allegedly been putting antiquities from some archaeological sites out on the market. Quite creative in the way it's finding to fund itself.
And
I'd say today it is self-funding, although it got seed money early.
And I'm happy to say that Andrew Tabler is back with us, and again, senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute. And all safe there where you are? No? Yes? No? We don't seem to have him. Okay, that's fair enough. Let me give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Douglas, going back to you, and even going back to what Liz Sly was saying about Mosul, is that some of the people in Mosul are welcoming ISIS, at least on a preliminary basis, feeling that life could be better under them than under the government-controlled forces that have been in places like Mosul. How should we understand that?
There's certainly a narrative in the Sunni community that they're being persecuted. And I think what we've got is, you know, ISIS has put us in this chicken-egg problem where it's hard to say, you know, who's to blame. You know, the stubborn fact is for the last 3 years, there have been car bombs going off in Baghdad on a regular basis, killing civilians, mostly Shia, because they're deliberately aimed at the Shia civilians. And, you know, the civilians are insisting that their government do something. Maliki doesn't have the type of precision tools that you know, we had in 2007 to root out a terrorist network, so he uses rather blunt tactics. These aren't helpful. On the other hand, you have to be sympathetic to a politician whose citizens are saying, you know, do something. Certainly, we would react the same with our president if there were bombs going off in our major cities.
Andrew Tabler, I am told, is back, senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute. Andrew, everything okay down there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Nice to have you back. We've been talking about ISIS, and we had a caller that had a question about where they get their money. As someone who has been following what's been going on in Syria, what do you think the answer to that question is?
They get them from private donors. Originally, they got their money from private donors in the Arab Gulf via money changers and banks in Kuwait. Now, there have been a number of efforts to crack down on these channels, but again, it's the issue of where states fail. Sometimes these states are unable to crack down on these money networks, and sometimes I think that they're unwilling. I think the analogous situation here, they're not the same. You know, history doesn't repeat itself, it only rhymes. But if you think about the arguments over who was funding and what sources were funding the IRA in Northern Ireland during the troubles there, you'll find that a hell of a lot of financing came from the United States. But, of course, the United States was aligned with Britain against the IRA. Well, it's coming from private donations because at its root, I think Douglas talked about this, at its root there is a deep political problem that goes back a long time, that is even close to being settled, and until you deal with that, the money ends up finding its way to these organizations that use terror and extreme tactics. Now, in the case of ISIS, it's extremely entrepreneurial. A lot of groups are. Hezbollah is as well in Lebanon on the Shia side. ISIS began not only selling crude oil, it began refining its own crude oil, making gasoline, and selling it back to the Assad regime, its sworn enemy, in order to make money. And they are relatively self-sustaining, but they still need these operations, these kind of plunder operations to push forward, and it's still a big part of their operations as a whole.
I mean, Douglas Sullivan, it sounds like the U.S. and Iraq is dealing with this very nimble organization that's, you know, if we're playing chess or even playing checkers, they are several steps ahead of at least the Iraqi government.
They're certainly a first-tier organization. I don't think it's, you know, too broad a step to say that ISIS has in many ways adopted the model of the Hezbollah they've been fighting in Syria for the last couple of years, learned a lot of lessons both from militarily but also politically on how to operate. Now, it'll be interesting to see how well that translates given the extremism of their view of Islam. You know, they really, as Liz Sly said, they really do want to take the region back to the 7th century. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the my experience is most Iraqi Sunnis really, really, really like to smoke. I've sometimes said jokingly that's what you know has put people over the edge when Al Qaeda tries to take that away from them. But we'll see how they react over the longer term. Clearly, there is this narrative they're being oppressed by the Maliki government. Rightly or wrongly, that's the narrative. It'll be interesting to see how long that narrative sustains as they start to live under the reality of ISIS rule and gets a taste of a different type of oppression.
Douglas, what do you think what would you advise the Maliki government to do this week or even today?
Well, again, we have two closely related problems. In terms of the ISIS problem, this is a very military one, and you know, the Iraqi government is going to fight it. And in terms of U.S. options, we really just have one. Is it air power, yes or no? It's type of a 0-1 option, although I guess using just drones instead of more robust air power would be kind of a 1/2 option there. But it's do nothing, use drones or use really robust naval, maybe even Air Force air power. That's really the only option we have for the ISIS problem in the immediate future. The political problem does need to be disentangled. This is going to lend itself to more diplomatic tools, more pressure. You know, the Maliki government needs to find some partners. It has reached out. It could certainly do more, but it takes two to tango, and all three, or three in this case, and all three of the ethno-sectarian groups in Iraq need to come together and figure out how they're going to do this. But I don't want to understate the difficulty. The issues between these groups are deep. They're existential. It's about what is Iraq going to be? How do the various types of citizens relate to the central government? How do the provinces and regions relate to the central government? Who owns all the resources that are in the ground? Do they belong to the people who happen to sit on top of them, or do they belong to the whole country? Mm-hmm. These are deep, deep issues that, you know, frankly, are much more complicated than, you know, U.S. entitlement reform.
And you keep going back to Congress there, and I understand that. But to you, Andrew Tabler, since we're talking about the sort of confluence of what's going on in Iraq and Syria, Syria being another, I guess, complicating factor when looking at Iraq or looking at these two countries, of course, that share a border.
Yeah, the problem I think we have, it's, I think, right, in terms of looking, making a military and a political distinction. But in both cases, I think the problem is we can't deal with this on a country-by-country basis. It would take some sort of strategy in order to, you know, first disentangle it and then roll it back. And the problem we have is that when we get involved with airstrikes on ISIS, that's going to be perceived as coming down on the side of the Shia in Iraq because of the makeup of the Maliki government there. That could actually push Sunnis as a whole together, meaning moderate Sunnis and other people that we're normally working with or normally in the fringes. It could push them actually closer together and into the arms of an organization like ISIS. Now, it would be substantially weakened.
Right.
It might not be posing a threat to cities, but politically it would have its costs. And unless we address that, both, I don't think you can really address what's going on in Iraq without addressing what's going on in Syria and vice versa. And the problem we have from the administration side, President Obama's been under, you know, pretty consistent criticism on this, is that we haven't had a strategy to deal with it. This problem crept up inside of Syria and grew substantially, and everybody's been watching it happen, and the Obama administration said, look, it really wasn't our problem. Turns out that it is partially our problem, and we're going to need to figure out how to deal with it.
We have a comment from Jawad from North Wales. I think the real problem in the region are the Baathists, not the Sunnis or Shiites. Douglas Ollivant, I'd be curious what you say back to Jawad.
Well, that's been a really interesting development this last week. We've seen the return of these neo-Baathist parties, the JRTN, which is like the army of the Nashabandi, which is a kind of, to my mind anyway, strange Sufi Baathist group, has also come up in Mosul, has been part of this, working side by side with ISIS, stating they're a nationalist group. This, of course, just inflames both the Shia and the Kurds, who, you know, suffered either genocide or something very, very closely approximating that under the Baath regime, certainly plays through. The bottom line is I don't think we really know what the relationship is between ISIS and these neo-Baathist groups in the north. I don't think we know who's playing who. If this was deliberately planned all along as a joint operation, or if JRTN and the other Baathists kind of bandwagon on ISIS's success and what's going to be the long-term nature of that relationship. My understanding is ISIS has already told the Baathists they have 24 hours to take down their posters of Saddam Hussein in Mosul, so it'll be interesting to see what the internal tensions are. So I guess my reply is the Baathists are a player, but it's not clear exactly how they fit and what their long-term future is.
And Douglas, picking up on what Andrew Tabler was saying earlier about the Obama administration being criticized for not having a policy for the region, we're talking about a very fluid and complex region, to say the least. What would be a policy that you could apply to this part of the world?
Well, that's you know, if I knew that, I'd probably be doing something else. No one has a good idea for Syria, but this is a huge part of the problem. And the Iraqis will come to say this immediately, that this is the United States' fault, not for the 2003 invasion of Iraq, but by letting ISIS metastasize in Syria. Their narrative is, you know, we could handle the low-grade insurgency that we had. We're trained for that. That's something we could deal with. This new group that came out of Syria is something new and different and that we just weren't prepared for.
Yeah, and Andrew Tabler, I'd be curious about your response.
I think that there was a way to, during the phase when ISIS was incubating or growing and metastasizing in Syria, there was a way to, through supporting moderate rebels there, to edge them out politically and otherwise. But that didn't happen. And I think, you know, the president's been criticized by Ambassador Robert Ford substantially. In particular, but you know, Douglas is right. There's no easy one answer, but it, you know, the growth of ISIS was so pronounced and so in our face. I think the problem was, from where I was sitting, was just a real. It wasn't so much about a plan or not, but it was just the lack of urgency that I found from the White House, and I think everybody did. And I think it's a fair criticism. It doesn't mean that the U.S. was expected to come up with all the solutions, but I think the U.S. is part of the solution there. It was part of the solution in Syria, and now we're going to have to figure out how to manage this situation.
Andrew, do you think ISIS is hurting the al-Qaeda brand, if I can use that word?
Well, ISIS is not in al-Qaeda. It's so severe it was actually kicked out of the organization in February. But what it is it is the Sunni. It is one of the Sunni jihadist groups that is carrying the mantle for Sunnis in Iraq and in Syria, and there are a lot of these other, you know, jihadist groups also on the Shia side as well, and they don't care about boundaries. And I think that's one of their big problems. You know, Douglas was right in saying earlier that the, you know, a group like ISIS doesn't care about the post-World War I boundaries in the Middle East. We have a lot invested in those because we, you know, the problem with the Syria conflict and just letting it alone and letting people fight it out was that Syria is like the row house in the middle of the block, and it's surrounded by all the houses that surround it are U.S. allies in one way, shape, or form. Now that's spilling out over the borders from Syria. And we're going to now own this, and it's going to be a lot more expensive to clean up once, you know, now that it's metastasized into something, you know, quite different from this low-grade insurgency that Douglas talked about into something much more formidable.
Well, we could go on. We have to end our discussion. Andrew Tabler, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Douglas Olivant, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a senior national security fellow with the New America Foundation. Andrew Tabler, senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including a podcast, Facebook, Twitter, and more. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.